Good morning, everybody. Thank you for giving me some time of your morning. Today we're going to be talking about Entity Framework 6. My name's Rowan Miller. I'm a program manager that works on the Entity Framework team at Microsoft. During our time today, we're going to cover a few brief topics, and then we're going to spend most of the time in demos. So we're going to talk about open source. EF6 is developed in an open source code base. I want to take a short amount of time to talk about the different ways that you can use Entity Framework to build a model. If any of you have been to a talk I did before, you've probably seen the slide, but we'll go over it quickly again. We'll talk about the features that are coming in Entity Framework 6 and what's new and what's cool. And then the bulk of our time will be spent in Visual Studio writing code, looking at new features. So EF6 has been developed in an open source code base. We basically took the code base for EF5, put it out on CodePlex, and that was our starting point for developing EF6. Being open source was about more than just having our source code public and available. Our team wanted to make a real effort to develop Entity Framework in a really open and transparent manner. So in addition to the source code, we have nightly builds available. So even if you don't want to get the EF source code and dig into it, you can get a nightly build that has the latest changes that our developers checked in yesterday. We don't have a second copy of the source code that we use for staging or anything. When people finish a feature, send it out for code review, it gets checked into the live CodePlex site, and then that night the features get built and they're available for you in a signed Microsoft package. Really, the only restriction on that package is it's not licensed for production use, and we don't offer support on the nightly builds. In addition to that, all of our issue tracking is done publicly on CodePlex, so you can look at our bugs, you can file bugs, you can file and vote on feature requests, and you can track features as we work on them. When we start working on features, our team starts by writing a short couple of page summary of the feature that we're going to do. We call this a feature spec or a one pager. And as soon as they're ready to go, we publish them on CodePlex too, often in draft form before we've even finished working on them. Every week, our team has a 2-hour meeting that we set aside to sit down and talk about design of new features. As folks are working on features and they hit problems or challenges, they might bring the API surface to the design meeting to talk about. We take very detailed notes during that, put them up on CodePlex for you to look at. I've actually got an example of them here, so let's take a quick look. So this is a feature specification that we put up for the task-based asynchronous support. You can see here we detail out why we're building the feature, the kind of challenges we've experienced along the way. We keep it up to date with new things. We put in sample code of what we want things to look like. So it really helps you guys be involved in the features even before we've coded them up. I mentioned the design meeting notes too, so here's some notes from our last design meeting. You can see they're pretty detailed. We bring a whole bunch of stuff to the design meeting. In this one, we were discussing the format that we write out when we log, down to some potential breaking changes to an interface and other such things. So the takeaway from this is we're not just about having our code public, but we really want to invite everybody here to be involved and help shape Entity Framework. In addition to being open source and having our code publicly available, we're also accepting contributions from external people. Only our team has commit rights to the repository. So Entity Framework is still very much a Microsoft product that we own and control. And anyone who wants to submit a request is held to the same quality bar and the same code review process as anyone on our team who wants to check in code. So far, we've taken 25 pull requests into EF6. 21 of these were accepted. 4 of them we rejected because they either weren't up to scratch or they didn't fit the direction that we wanted Entity Framework to go. So far, those requests have come from 8 contributors. Actually, these numbers are a little outdated. We're now up to 22 accepted and from 9 different contributors as of a couple of days ago. Now, this might make you nervous. If you guys work in an enterprise, the thought of using open source software could be alarming, especially if it's one that's accepting contributions. So open source is just about how we develop the software. When it comes time for us to ship, We run the same quality checks. We do test passes and lengthy test passes on everything. It comes with the same support. So the license and the support agreement for EF6 is no different than EF5, which was developed purely in-house. And like I said, we have one of the things that you want from a Microsoft product is to know that it's going to work and know that it's going to be supported. So we're still following all the same processes when it comes to shipping quality software that is licensed and you can depend on in your business. So let's talk very quickly about the different ways that you can use Entity Framework to build an application. You've probably heard of model first, database first, code first, and it can be really confusing, particularly if you haven't seen this slide before. There's really just two very simple questions that will help you pick the right workflow. First question, outside of your control. Are you targeting a new database? So greenfield scenario, empty database with no tables, or maybe you don't even have a database yet. Or are you targeting an existing database, maybe one your DBA has built for you? Could be one that's an existing application and you need to map to the existing schema. So that's outside your control, but completely inside your control is whether you would rather model using boxes and lines in a designer, drag and drop style, or whether you just want to do all your modeling by writing code, writing your classes and writing extra mapping, etc. So filling in the boxes, model first, we draw some boxes and lines, we generate a database from that, and the classes that we're going to write code against are also automatically generated from the boxes and lines model. In a similar manner, database first uses the boxes and lines designer, but you start by reverse engineering the model from the database. You're then free to tweak mapping, change class names, etc., and those classes, again, are automatically generated from the model. In code first, we can either write some classes and potentially some additional configuration to change the shape of our database, and then we can generate the database from our code. If we change our code model, then we can go ahead and use code first migrations to apply those changes to the database. The fourth square is probably the most misunderstood of all of them. Code first can create a database, but you can also use it to map to an existing database. You can do this by handwriting all your classes and specifying the mapping to go to the existing database, or you can download the EF Power Tools from Visual Studio Gallery, and they'll have some inbuilt functionality to reverse engineer a code-first model for you. The other question we get, code-first is new. So a lot of folks get worried that code-first is the new way of doing things and the designer is the old way of doing things. That's absolutely not the case. Both are perfectly valid. Our team spends a lot of time working on both products, so you just pick and choose the one that works best for you. So let's talk about what's coming in EF6. Regardless of whether you're using Code First or the EF Designer to build your model, here are the main features that we're introducing in EF6. So in .NET 4.5, we introduced the async and await keywords. But in EF5, we didn't have time to add support for those for query and save. But now in EF6, we do. We introduce connection resiliency. As we move to databases hosted in the cloud, we become a lot more susceptible to drop connections and other transient faults that can occur as we interact with the database. So in EF6, we introduce connection resiliency to help with retry logic. We actually also ship a connection retry strategy designed specifically for SQL Azure. So it knows about the exceptions that come from SQL Azure and knows which ones can be retried and has appropriate defaults for the length of time between retries and the number of retries. If you're like me, you probably hate writing XML in web and app.config. So in EF6, we introduce code-based config to give you a nice code-based experience as an alternative, not a replacement to the config file. We now have the ability to intercept commands as they're sent to the database for logging, or you even have the opportunity to mess around with the command before it's actually executed. And as always, we're trying to improve the performance, make EF6 faster and more lightweight than the previous version. So we've got some great performance improvements coming. Then these next two features just apply if you're modeling with code first. We're going to see both of these in action today. We have custom conventions, where you can write your own conventions to supplement our existing ones, and we're also introducing support for insert, update, and delete store procedures. So I said that's the big features, There's quite a few other things coming as well. Here are some of them from our team. I'm not going to run down the list, but I just wanted to show that we've been doing a lot of work in EF6. Some of that's big features, and some of it is doing the little things that make it a nice API that makes it easy for you to achieve your tasks. In addition to that, we've also got some cool features coming from our contributors. A lot of our contributions are bug fixes and simple little changes, but we also have some decent-sized features coming, including one guy who submitted a fix to improve the warm-up time for large models. So it's great to see things like performance improvements coming from the community also. So that's enough of slides. Let's jump into some demos. I showed you this diagram before, and remember, most of the features apply to all four boxes on the screen here. The easiest one to show them to you with is using code first to a new database. So for the demo, I'm going to focus on that top right square, but know that most of the stuff I'm showing you applies to all four squares. Now, I need a little bit of audience participation just to help me work out how to do the most interesting and most educational demos for you. So if I could just get a show of hands, how many people have actually used code first to a new database before? Okay, so we've got probably a third maybe. And out of those people, how many folks have used code first migrations? Okay, probably less than a quarter of the audience. Great. So this is a level 300 talk, but because a lot of folks haven't seen code first to a new database or migrations, we're going to kind of ramp up into the new features. So let's head over to Visual Studio. And I don't like doing demos that are, here's one we prepared earlier with an existing project, so I'm going to start from new project. But to avoid you watching me type lots of code, I am going to use some code snippets. But this just reassures you that I'm not doing anything special or sneaky behind the scenes. So we're going to use a console app to look at some of these new features. And the first thing I'm going to do is install the Entity Framework package. And we're going to pass the dash pre switch. This means I'm happy to have a pre-release version of EF. And you can see here I've downloaded EF600 Beta 1-20604. This is actually yesterday's nightly build. So we've got the latest bits for EF6. The first thing we need with code first is a model. So I'm going to add a new class. And I'll use a code snippet to pull in a model. It'd be nice if all code was that fast to write, hey? Okay, so a very simple model. You're probably used to this one. We have a blog, which has many posts. A post has many comments. And a comment has a status. A status might be something like pending moderation, or approved, or marked as spam. Notice that our model has no dependencies on EF. It's a POCO, or plain old CLR object model. We now need a context, so we're going to add another class. We'll call this one the blogging context, and this is going to inherit from DB context, which is an EF type. We need some DB sets on here for each type in our model. So this class is known as our derived context or our DB context, and it represents a session with the database, allowing for us to query and save data. Now that we've got that sorted, let's write some code to use it. So this method that I've got on the screen here starts, it news up a context. Context is disposable, so it's wrapped in a using. We go ahead and create a new blog and save it out to the database. We then use a link query to pull back all blogs ordered by name, and we go and write them out to the console in the order that they came back. Let's just call this method from our main. And let's go ahead and run. Our first run will take a little bit of time. Remember, we're doing code first to a new database. So code first is going ahead and creating the database in the background for us. Remember, this is just one box. So you're not forced to have code first create a database for you. It's perfectly valid to also map to an existing database. If we go and look at our local DB instance, we'll see that it's created a teched.bloggingcontext database. This is the fully qualified name of our context. And we'll see there's a table for every type in the model. Okay, it's just used some conventions to work things out. The columns are named after the properties in my classes as well. You'll also notice in the database that there's this migrations history table. Let's talk a little bit about migrations. So what if I go ahead and I want to make some changes to my model? I need a way to push those changes to the database. So I'm going to run the enable migrations command. So for migrations, we have a command line experience from Package Manager console. There's also a command line tool that's available within the NuGet package, so you can do this stuff from a command line as well. So enabling migrations created this migrations folder for me, and it put in there a configuration and an initial migration. The configuration class on the screen here just allows me to set up some default settings for migrations. One of the new things in EF6 is a context key. So I can now have multiple code-first models targeting the same database, and I use a key to differentiate them. This is what migrations will use to work out which tables and which migrations belong to which model. The other thing it did was create an initial create migration. And this represents the changes that were pushed to the database when it was automatically created when I ran my application. Let's make a quick change to the model. So we're going to add a rating property to our blog class. We're then going to use the add migration command. We get to give these things a name, so we'll call it blog rating. The add migration command looks at what the model looked like when the last migration was created. It looks at what the model looks like now, works out that there's a new rating property, which means I need a new rating column in the database. So it goes ahead and scaffolds a new migration that will apply that change to the database. This is scaffolded code, so I'm free to edit it if I want to. One thing I might want to do is specify a default value for the rating column for all the existing data that's in my database. I want it to start with 3. By default, migrations would use the CLR default for the type, so it would have been 0 if I hadn't added this code. I can now use the update database command to apply this change to the database. So if I go and look at my blog table, I see that the rating column is now there at the bottom of the table. I'm going to take a quick look at the data in the migrations history table. You see here, this is how migrations is keeping track of what's been applied to the database. So when I first added the blog rating migration, it hadn't been applied to the database, so there would have just been one row in here for the initial create migration. When I said update database, migration looks at the database, sees that it's got just the initial create migration applied. It looks at my code and sees that there's 2 migrations there, so it picks up the pending one and applies it to the database. Okay, so that's a quick primer into code first and migrations. Let's start looking at some new features in EF6. So the first one that I want to look at is custom code first conventions. So this allows you to do bulk configuration for multiple entities or types and multiple properties in your model. We built this because a lot of people don't like our default conventions or their model doesn't follow it. And this meant you had to write a lot of repetitive code over and over again to configure things that don't line up with our default conventions. This is boring. It's also error prone. So you should use custom conventions either when the patterns in your model don't line up with ours. So you might use a different naming convention for your primary keys. So rather than having to configure every primary key, you can tell us your new convention. You can also use it to change some of our defaults, like the default data types or the default column names that we choose. So I mentioned primary key names as an example. Code first expects your primary keys to either be called ID or the type name followed by ID. And we also give you the option, if you don't follow those conventions, to go and put this key annotation on each property that should be a primary key. So that's what I've had to do in this model, because in my model, all the primary keys are called key instead of ID. So let's go through and strip out these annotations. And if I were to try and run my application now, I'd get an exception. I'll zoom in for you, and you can see that it's CodeFirst is complaining that it doesn't know what the keys are for the types in my model. So to write conventions, I'm going to override the onModelCreating method in my context. Folks who have used the Fluent API might be familiar with this. Just a quick example of what you could do in here. As an alternative to putting the key annotation on my classes, I could have pulled up the configuration for blog and used the hasKey method in here and just specified the properties of the key for blog. So I could write that four times for every type in my model, but let's do something better. Let's say model builder. We're going to look at all properties across all the classes. We're going to write a little where clause. And this gives me the property info, or the reflection information of the property in the CLR. So there's lots of things I can get from here, but one is the name of the property. So we're going to be configuring all properties where the name is key. And I can then do a configure. And what I get here is something that looks exactly like the Fluent API, but this is actually a very weakly typed version. So the Fluent API is very strongly typed, and it used generics, and you would use lambdas to specify properties. In the conventions version, it's weakly typed, so you could pass in types, or you could pass in strings to represent your property names. For us, we just want to configure it to say this is a key. So with that done, let's go and run our application again. And we see that everything works now. So that was a convention to specify the keys. Let's look at another one. Let's look at column names. So I've got a helper method here, which will take a CLR property info, so the reflection information for a type, and it's then going to calculate a column name that I would rather use. So instead of using Pascal case, which is what my C-sharp code is written in, I want to convert it to lowercase with underscores between the words. Maybe that's something my DBA would like. In addition to that, I also want to tack the type name onto the start. So I've got an example there. The comment.key property should be comment underscore key. And comment.author URL should be comment underscore author underscore URL. So you've seen this one. We're going to pull up all the properties. We're not going to use a where clause this time because we want this to apply to all properties. We'll call the hasColumnName method. We're going to call our getColumnName method as well. The property is the configuration for the property, but on there we've exposed the CLR property info. So it'll give me the reflection information for this particular property. Now this is going to result in changes to our database because all our column names are going to change. So let's go ahead and add the next migration. And we'll see that migrations has basically scaffolded out a whole bunch of renames to apply this convention. Let's go ahead and update the database. And let's just refresh the blogs table. And we'll see the new column names applied. So I'm not necessarily suggesting that this is a good naming convention for you to use in databases, but it just shows you how to use the new features. If I zoom in on this, you'll also see that by default, CodeFirst is choosing nvarchar max as the default data type for strings. That may not make sense in my situation. I may have very short string data, so I'd rather use something a little bit smaller. Let's write another convention to change that. So I'm going to do model builder. This time I'm going to use a generic overload of properties to say I want to configure all properties that are of type string. And there's a hasMaxLength method. So we're going to say the default length for a string is 200. Now I should mention that conventions give you a default, but you can then do explicit configuration to override what you did in conventions. So if you have one string that you'd rather have a default length of 500, you can explicitly configure that property and it will do just that. Let's add a migration for this one. And we should see a whole bunch of older columns to drop everything down to 200. I'll go ahead and update the database. And we're good. So let's take a look at our next feature. So database command logging. This gives you the opportunity to get a log of every command and query that we send to the database. This gives you a very easy way to look at what's happening. So in the past, to do this, you would have had to go and install SQL Management Studio and file up SQL Profiler, and that's a whole bunch of work just to see what Entity Framework is doing. I think perhaps one of the most useful things, or the most useful places to use this, is when you just want to understand what EF is doing. Whether you're using some new features of it, or you're a new user to EF, and you want to wrap your head around how EF translates link queries into SQL. It can also be good if you've written a query and it's not giving you back the results you expect, or you're calling save changes and the stuff that you expect isn't happening in the database. This will give you some insight into what EF is doing. I wouldn't recommend using the log as a way to try and tune your applications for performance, but if you know you have a section of your application that is spending a lot of time in the database, then looking at the log can help you identify which query might be long running. I'm going to go back over to our program. Let's close down some windows. So I'm going to start in this section just looking at the easiest way to wire up logging, but then a little bit later we're going to look at some more robust and feature-centric ways of actually doing logging as well. So here I can do database.log. The database.log is basically just allows me to register an action of string. So this is something that's going to happen every time I send a query to the database. One of the great things is that that is super easy to wire up to the console. So I can just say console.write. And now let's run our application. Okay, so we can see all of our SQL is getting written out to the screen now. We see the select statement for our query, and we see the insert statement as a result of saving the new blog. Some things to call out here. We're putting out the total time that it took for it to complete, so if you know you've got a slow running page, you could scan down through the queries and see if you have a long running query there. We also write out the parameters, so you know what parameters are getting passed into the parameterized SQL. It's also very easy to customize what gets written out here. If you look at the feature specification for this particular feature on the Coplex site, you'll see ways to customize the text that gets written out here. The log property is also really great for demoing the next set of features. So the next one I'm going to show you is mapping to store procedures using code first. This is, in particular, the insert, update, and delete store procedures that get called when you save. This has been a real consistent ask since we released code first, and the reason is that a lot of enterprises actually require you to map to store procedures. So this gives us some reasons why we might need it. One was we might be mapping to an existing database, a legacy database that uses store procedures. We could be working in an organization where the DBA only lets us access the database using store procedures. There are also some reasons that we might opt into using Sprox as well. If you needed to run some additional logic during save, and it's something that is best done in the database, then a store procedure is the perfect way to do it. There's also situations where EF can't map to your model. You might have a quite complex table structure that EF just isn't capable of mapping to. In this case, you can map to a store procedure, because EF can do that, and then in your store procedure, you can handle the logic to write out to your table structure. Another example here would be two databases on the same server. EF isn't capable of mapping to two databases, but if they're on the same server or you're using linked servers, then you can kind of fake it out by using store procedures to write out to the second database. Let's go see this in action. So I'm going to start configuring the blog entity. And I'll see that one of the options I have now is a map to store procedures. There's two overloads of this method. One is empty, and it will just use a set of conventions to work out what the store procedure should look like. This could be code first creating store procedures for me, or it could be me mapping to existing store procedures. If I am mapping to existing store procedures, it's highly likely that the default conventions aren't going to work for me. So there's a second overload of this, which takes some configuration specified in a Lambda. We're going to look at this in a second. That allows me to override all of or some of the conventions for store procedures. So I could change store procedure names, I can change parameter names, things like that. For the moment, let's just go with the empty one that's going to use the default conventions. Now, at this point, when we first built this feature, you would have had to go to your database and add the store procedure. The problem is you have no idea really what the store procedure is supposed to look like, and who wants to go and write SQL anyway. So let's add a migration. Unless you're a DBA, you might like writing store procedures if you're a DBA. I don't. So migrations has gone and written out some code that will scaffold a store procedure for me. We see one here for insert, one here for update, one for delete. This is partially a strongly typed API, so the signature for the store procedure is specified in code at the top. So we have the name, we have a list of the parameters and the data types that we're using for them. Then the actual body of the store procedure is just written in SQL, and you're free to edit that as you want. We're going to look at editing in a little bit later, but let's just go update our database. If we go and look now, let's look under programmability and store procedures. We'll see that our three store procedures are there now. Let's run our application. And looking at this, we can now see that instead of calling an insert command, we're now calling our store procedure. You can see the values of the parameters that are getting passed in as well as the execution time and a whole bunch of other useful information. So that's great if I'm creating my own database and I like the default conventions, but what if I'm mapping to existing store procedures in an existing database, or I just don't like the conventions that CodeFirst is using? To do that, we can go ahead and specify a Lambda in here, which is going to allow us to give it some configuration. So in here, I get the ability to individually customize the three different store procedures. For this demo, I'm just going to worry about the insert one. Let's start by changing the name. Instead of calling it blog insert, let's call it create blog. And let's look at one of the parameters too. Let's say the parameter for the blog rating property. So I use a strongly typed Lambda to specify the property that I want to configure the parameter for. And then I get to give it a name. So this should probably be called, maybe it's called blog score in the database. Okay, now that we've done that, let's add a migration. We can see here migrations has said, well, we renamed the store procedure, so let's go ahead and apply the rename. And we also made some changes to it, so it's running an alter for the insert store procedure. Now, I could just go and apply this to the database, but a lot of the time, the reason that I want to use store procedures is because I want to do something extra in there. One good example of that might be writing out to an auditing log. So in this case, I'm going to create an extra table. This is one of my favorite things about migrations, is they're great for applying changes in your model, but you can also add extra constructs that aren't really represented in your model. So I'm creating a completely separate table that has nothing to do with my model here. So I'm saying it's a blog creation log table. It's going to record the key of the blog that was inserted, who it was created by, and when it was created. I've got a bit of extra SQL here, which I'm just going to go and throw into our store procedure. So after we've created the blog, after we've got back the key of the blog, I'm then going to write out to the blog creation log. Let's go update our database, and then let's just run our application. We see now that it's calling the new store procedure name, create blog. And let's refresh the tables in our database. We'll see blog creation log is there, and it's writing out the fact that I had just created a blog at 10:50 a.m. Okay, so that's great. We can create store procedures and customize them for one entity in our model. But what if we want to do it for every entity? I certainly don't want to go ahead and write this really verbose code for every store procedure. Fortunately, we also added store procedure support to custom conventions. So I can pull up the model builder. So far, we've looked at configuring properties, but with custom conventions, I also have the opportunity to specify conventions for every type in my model. If I zoom in here, I'll see things like being able to change the table that the type maps to, being able to specify the key, being able to ignore it from the model, things like that. Let's just say for every type in our model, we want to map to store procedures and just use the default conventions for finding the name and parameters, etc. Let's go ahead and add a migration. And I'll see here now CodeFirst has calculated store procedures for all the remaining types in my model. Let's go apply that to the database. And our store procedures are refreshing at the moment. And you'll see the procedures for every type in our model. The important thing to call out, remember I said that explicit configuration overrides anything that you do with default or with custom conventions. So we had a custom convention saying map to store procedures using the default conventions, but our explicit configuration for the blog type, which said, hey, no, don't do that, use a different name and some different parameter names, that overrides the default conventions. So introducing all of that, the order of precedence when it comes to configuring your model is anything done explicitly with the Fluent API, followed by anything done with data annotations, followed by anything done with custom conventions, followed by anything done by our default conventions. All right, next feature. Async and await, like I said, were introduced in .NET 4.5, but EF5 didn't have support for them. In EF6, we added it because the appropriate use of async, and I say appropriate because async isn't the right thing to use in every scenario. If you want to know more about that, I did a talk back on Monday. I think its code was dev B337. It's about ASP.NET, but if you want an intro to async and where it's useful and when it should be applied, I'd recommend taking a look at that talk. But the reason we use it is to improve performance and scalability. That could be getting more web requests through on our server, or that could be having a more responsive or quicker refreshing UI in a client application. So we get better or more requests through on a web server by reducing the number of threads that we're using when we process requests. Again, we improve client UI by not blocking the main thread. So with an asynchronous operation, I fire off an operation, and then there's no CPU time required on the current thread until that operation completes. So a database query or a command is one example. There's nothing for my managed code to actually do while it's waiting for the database engine to apply the changes or to get the data for the query. The other reason that async can be useful is for parallelism. So I want to kick off and do two things at once. But as with most components that support async, you can't do two asynchronous operations on the same instance of a context. So it has limited uses within an application, but if you need to pull a lot of data back quickly and you don't need it to all be tracked, then you can use separate context instances to pull back multiple queries asynchronously. So to use async, I need to mark my method as async and task. Marking the method as async is just telling the compiler, at some point I'm going to do an operation, and there's no CPU time required from the current thread while that operation completes. At this point, the method is going to return, but it hasn't finished executing. So instead of returning void in this case, or returning a result in the case of methods that return a result, I'm going to return a task instead. Then whoever calls the method can monitor the task, and when it's complete, it knows that the code has completed, in this case, because it was a void method, or if it was a method that returned a result, it could get that result from the task. I'm going to update our main method to capture the task. And then at the end, we're going to do something that's not really asynchronous. We're going to wait on the task to complete. So at this point, the thread is actually going to lock, but that's okay. What would be great to do is if I could do something else to the UI in between to show that my thread's not blocked and that execution can continue. So I'm going to pull in a NuGet package. This is going to be the quote of the day package. This isn't something you can get on NuGet unless I get a lot of requests and I may publish it. This is just something I have locally on my machine for this demo. So we're going to go ahead and use the quotes class from that package. We're going to get a quote and write it out to the console. So this should help us see the order of execution of things within our application. Now let's go and update our method so it actually does something asynchronous. Let's start with a query to the database. So I use the await keyword to tell the compiler that the stuff after the await keyword is something that's going to go off and it's not going to require CPU time from my thread. So at this point, the method would return, and once that asynchronous operation is completed, I'll need to fire back up the code from this method and finish executing it on the current thread. To do that, I need to swap to an asynchronous version of toList. But there isn't one at the moment, so I need to go and import the system.data.entity namespace. The reason I need to do this is that things like toList are extension methods to do with link. They're extension methods because they operate on iQueryable, which isn't anything to do with EF, it's to do with link. The asynchronous versions are specific to EF, but we obviously couldn't go ahead and add them to iQueryable because that doesn't belong to us. So we've implemented them as extension methods in the system data entity namespace. The methods that we have asynchronous overloads for are the methods that actually cause a query to be executed in the database. This is things like toList or first or count or things like that. You won't see an asynchronous version of the where method because where just modifies the query in memory. It doesn't actually result in the query being executed in the database. So now that we've done that, let's run our application. So we see our query getting executed. Then before the results have come back and been written to the screen, we see the quote of the day being written out to the screen. And then when that asynchronous operation completes, we see that all the blogs get written out as well. Let's go one step further. We're doing an await on the query, which is freeing up the thread to process the UI. Let's also await on the save changes. Because the save changes takes a little bit longer to execute, scroll up a little bit, we see the command being sent off to the database. We then see the quote of the day coming back, but because it took more than a couple of milliseconds for the query to execute, we see from the logger that the completed logging actually gets written out after the quote of the day. So our method is returning super quickly, letting the program continue on and do its other work, and then it's blocking at the end and waiting for the task to complete. Okay, code-based configuration. Like I said before, we've always supported configuring Entity Framework using the app and web.config files. For a lot of people, including myself, code is a much easier, more comfortable, and more discoverable way to do things. If I'm doing configuration, I would love to have IntelliSense show me the methods and give me some documentation about what they do. So you're free to use code-based configuration any time that you want to change your config. We're going to look at some examples of this, but one opportunity would be registering other database providers. You can also use it if you're using an inversion of control container to wire up the configuration for your application. The simplest way to do things is to add a class that derives from DB configuration. This class gives you some very simple, easy-to-use methods that are very strongly typed and let you see what configuration is available, what types you need to implement to change the configuration, and things like that. If you derive from DB configuration and put it in the same assembly as your context, we'll find it automatically and wire it up at runtime. If you want to put it in another assembly, that's fine also. You'll just have to do a little bit of work either in the config file or using some attributes to let us know where your configuration lives. I would expect 95-99% of people using code-based configuration to use this approach. If you want to do something a little bit more complicated, then we have a dependency resolver as well. The entry point to this is exposed on DB configuration, and it gives you a much more flexible but way less strongly typed way of configuring services that Entity Framework will use. Most of you probably won't use this when you're writing an application. This is something that a database provider or a third-party plugin would use to register their services when their component is loaded. An example of that might be when you install a provider for MySQL. The provider might go ahead and register the SQL generator to use for migrations. So let's see code-based config in action. I'm going to add another class. We'll call it myconfig. Like I said, this class is going to derive from DB configuration. Don't know if folks know this. If you type CTOR and hit tab, it'll create a constructor for you in your class. Let's just look at the methods we have here. So I can see there's a whole bunch of strongly typed methods that tell me all the different things that I can configure. One of those is to set the pluralization service. This is the service that Entity Framework uses any time it needs to take a singular word and make it plural, or a plural word and make it singular. One example of where this is used is when CodeFirst uses the conventions to work out what my database looks like. If we look at the tables in our database, just collapse things down a bit, we'll see that our class was called blog and comment and post. But EF, with its default conventions, has gone ahead and applied pluralization to it, and it's got a plural table name. It's actually mispluralized one of them. The plural of status is actually statuses. Someone filed this bug, and I actually had to go and look it up in the dictionary to make sure they were right. It seemed weird to me, but it is statuses. So until we go ahead and fix this bug, it'll be better if we register our own pluralization service to fix it. So we're going to implement the more better English pluralization service. And for this service, I'm basically wrapping our English pluralization service that we ship in the box. For almost every case, I'm delegating down to that to do the pluralization or singularization. The one thing I'm doing is special casing the word status, or any text that ends in the word status, and saying, if you want to pluralize that, just tack an ES onto the end. Now that we've done that, we can go ahead and register our more better English pluralization service. I'll build. Now we would expect this to result in changes to the database, right? So let's go add a migration. And we'll see that indeed migrations is, or CodeFirst is picking up our new pluralization service and is therefore resulting in a new table name. One of the reasons we decided to do this DB configuration-based code-based config is that it's actually really hard to discover configuration that you do in code. In the past, we'd allowed you to do things like registering database initializers and stuff like that, and folks were kind of free to write that code wherever they wanted. If you're writing a web application, you probably did it in global.asax. If you're writing a console app, you probably do it at the start of your main method. If you're then using tooling like migrations, it's virtually impossible for our tooling to pick up all that configuration and apply it. But with DB configuration, it's super easy for tooling to check your config file to see what configuration you have there, and then also look for the presence of this DB configuration class. So before we saw some very simple logging, where we were just using the database.log property. Database.log is actually implemented using a new feature called interceptors. Interceptors allow us to intercept operations that Entity Framework is doing. One example of this interception is database commands. As they're being sent off to the database, we give you the opportunity to intercept them. You can do this using the add interceptor method. I want to call out something here. If you go and download EF6 Beta 1, which we just released, it actually won't have this method. This is one of the advantages of making nightly builds public, is this thing was checked in a couple of days ago, and you don't have to wait a month or maybe a few weeks for us to do the next beta of EF6. You're free to go and grab the nightly build and try it out straight away. So we can't add an interceptor yet because we don't have one. So let's add another class. Actually, before we add our class, let's install a new NuGet package. So one of the great things I can do is wire up to logging frameworks. So I'm going to go ahead and install Nlog. This is just a third-party framework that allows me to do very simple logging from a .NET application. Now let's add a class. We'll call it the Nlog Interceptor. Just resolve a couple of references here. So IDB command interceptor is an interface in Entity Framework Assembly. And we can see from the implementation here that it gives us an interception point when a query is being executed and then when the query returns. So you can think of this as a pass-through layer that sits in between EF and the database. In my example, I'm just going to intercept every time a query completes. So you see there's a few different methods here. These methods replicate the methods that are called on DB command. For each of the ones that have completed, I go ahead and call this helper method I've got. If everything executes appropriately, I just trace out some information using Nlog. And if there's an error, I write out some warning information and then also trace the query text. While all I'm doing is actually writing out what's coming in, you actually have the ability to properly intercept the command. So at this point, you can actually mess around with the command text and change what gets sent to the database. In fact, if you have a pattern where you know you can get the results from memory without hitting the database, then you can actually wire up the executing method so that the query never actually hits the database and you just return the result directly from the executing method. So now that we've got Nlog wired up, let's go to our config class and register our interceptor. Now, Nlog has a set of configuration that configures which operations get recorded and where they get recorded. That's done in the nlog.config file. I'm just going to go ahead and uncomment the default ones, which is basically going to write out to a text file in my bin directory, and it's going to write out everything, trace, warning, everything will get written out. Let's now run our application. Looks like we made changes. We should probably apply them to the database. There we go. The exception that I just got on the screen was EF telling me that I'd made changes to my model, but those changes hadn't been applied to the database. The reason that occurred is because I scaffolded a command, or scaffolded a new migration, and you guys all believed me that the database was going to be updated, but I didn't actually go and run the update database command. So now that everything's back in sync, we've run. Let's drop down to File Explorer. We'll look in bin, debug. Nlog by default is going to write out to this logs folder, and I see a .log text file here with all of the queries that we were sending written out. I want to show you guys something cool that I didn't show you before. So we'd expect select commands and insert, update, delete commands to get written out. But we're actually getting more than that. We're getting everything that EF does with the database. So we saw before that there was an exception when I ran because EF said, hey, there's been some changes to your model that you haven't applied to the database. And it does that by checking the migrations history table. And if I scroll up a little bit, I can actually see that query being sent to the database as well. Here's a query to the migrations history table that CodeFirst is using to check what's going on, the state of my database, and whether it matches the state of my model. So you really get a peek at everything that EF is doing under the covers. So Codebase Config is really cool for plugging in your own services and changing things. But I mentioned before that third-party components can also use this same infrastructure to plug in services and intercept what EF is doing. One really cool example I've seen of that is a product called Glimpse. So here I have a very simple MVC application that I've written. I've just implemented a quotes controller. So you saw my hideous quotes of the day coming back from the database before. This is an MVC controller that allows me to manage the database that contains those quotes. You can see here it's just using the default scaffolding using Entity Framework. To this project, I've simply gone and installed two packages. I installed glimpse.mvc and glimpse.ef6. And then if I swap over to the application in IE, and I'll just refresh the page, I get this little glimpse icon down the bottom. So in the past, you could do this kind of thing of intercepting commands, but it was incredibly difficult to do. But we've been working with folks like the people that write Glimpse and people who write other third-party components to make it much easier for them to plug in and intercept things. So when Glimpse runs against EF6, it actually uses the dependency resolver to inject its own service to intercept database commands. So you can see here, when I load the page, it's writing out the select command. And if I browse to the details page, you can see the commands that are being executed under the covers here. I think this kind of thing is really cool because it really helps you write better applications and understand what is going on under the covers. This is just another cool view that's showing this is the total time that the connection to the database was open, the yellow bar. And then the purple bar, in the context of the whole page lifecycle, shows the amount of time we're actually waiting for a command to come back from the database. Actually, let's look at a couple of other things while I'm here. So one cool but not very well known tool that our team ships is the Entity Framework Power Tools. These power tools is some functionality that we are planning to add to the designer in the future, but we just haven't had the time to polish it up and make it production-ready code yet. We didn't want that to stop us giving you the tools to make them useful. So I just wanted to demo a couple of things they do. If I go and look at the extensions and updates, you'll see that I've got Entity Framework Power Tools Beta 3 installed. So this is available on Visual Studio Gallery. Let's go back to the application we were working in. And if I right-click on a class that contains a context, I can go Entity Framework and View Entity Data Model. When I do that, EF is going to run the CodeFirst pipeline, work out what my model looks like, and then give me a visualization of it using the EF designer. So this is just a neat, easy way to see what CodeFirst is calculating without having to, you know, wade through your database and look at SQL scripts and things to see what it's doing. I mentioned before that you can do code first to an existing database. Let's just create a new project quickly. If I right-click on a project, I have another option, which is reverse engineer code first. I'm going to point this at my LocalDB instance. And I can pick a database that I want to reverse engineer from. I'll use the quotes one. At this point, the power tools go and chug away. I'm just going to go and install the EF NuGet package. The power tools would have done it for me automatically, but I'm actually offline at the moment, so they can't. And so the power tools have created a few things for me here. They've created a quote context, which is a DB context wired up and ready to work with the quotes database. You'll see the syntax here in the constructor, the name equals quotes context. That's just telling it the connection string for this context comes from the config file. So if I look in the config file, I'll see a connection string wired up there to connect to my local DB instance. It's created a simple little POCO class to represent every type in my model. In this case, there's just one table in the database. And then it's also generated some Fluent API configuration to specify how that class maps to the columns in the database. So if you want to use code first rather than the EF Designer and you want to target an existing database, go and grab the power tools. They'll get rid of a lot of the grunt work for you at the start. The power tools do a few other things too, but they're the two most interesting options. One thing I forgot to mention on the Codebase config, Codebase config is great, but web and app.config is the easiest way to change settings when you deploy to production, right? So you can do your configuration in code, but you still have the option of putting stuff in web and app.config, and it will overwrite anything that you've done with code. So I was looking at my deck last night, and I realized I got to the end, and we showed you all these new features, but we hadn't actually told you when you were going to be able to use them. So I added this in last night. Beta 1 is out at the moment. Beta 1 includes the runtime, which is up on NuGet, and that works in any version of Visual Studio where you target .NET 4. So you can target .NET 4, .NET 4, 5, you're good. Beta 1 is our first release that includes Visual Studio tooling, so we're making some updates to the EF Designer and EF 6 as well. A lot of the updates that we're making to the Designer are around being able to ship it out of band. So up until now, we've basically just been able to ship with Visual Studio. There was one exception to that where we tried to do an out-of-band release of the EF Designer, and it was horrible, and it destroyed everybody's machines, so we've done a lot of work to make that a lot better so we can ship in between releases of Visual Studio as well. So there aren't a whole bunch of new features. It will work with EF 6. You get the new runtime features that I talked about. The Visual Studio 2012 version of the tooling is available on Download Center now. The 2013 version of it will come out with a preview of 2013. Our final RTM of EF 6 will be available alongside the RTM of VS 2013. I don't have dates for that, so I can't tell you, sorry. If I did, I'm sure I wouldn't be allowed to anyway. Between now and then, there will be a bunch of new previews. We're going to keep polishing the runtime. All the main features are there, but we are going to keep polishing stuff, so we'll keep doing previews. The tooling, we're still working on that quite vigorously too, so there'll be lots more previews of that. Some places to point you to. My blog is there. I've been blogging quite a bit about EF6. In particular, you'll find the source code from this talk up there. So if you want that, it's available to you probably in the next couple of days. Our team blog is a great place to stay up to date with what's happening on the EF team. We post there when we do releases, so you'll never miss a beta or an alpha or an RTM release if you follow that. If you want to use EF5, which is our current RTM release, you want to head to msdn.com/data/EF. We will be updating that site with EF6 content when EF6 RTMs, but until then, for EF6, you need to head to Codeplex. As we wrap up EF6, we're starting to think about the next version and what's going to be in it, so I'd really encourage you to get on User Voice and vote for your favorite features. You can also vote on Codeplex as well. And if you want to stay up to date with what the team is doing in between our alpha and beta releases, kind of day-to-day happenings of the team, then you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got a few minutes left, so I'm going to take some questions, but I know that a lot of folks don't stick around for questions. So I want to thank you for your time. I also want to really encourage you to go and fill out a session evaluation, not just for this session, but for all of them. There's two reasons I want you to do that. One, it helps us make TechEd better. If you tell us what sessions you like, which speakers you like, what topics you like, then the next TechEd is going to have more of that for you. The other reason is I want to help you guys. I want to help everyone at conferences. I want to help you learn and use our technologies. So if there's things that I can do better as a speaker, I really want to know about that. And if there's things that are good in my presentation that you like, I want to do more of that. So help us make TechEd better and other conferences. Help me be a better speaker. I'm going to thank you very much for your time, and if you have questions, there are microphones that you're free to step up to.